Okay. I've entitled this the demythologizing the name of or the divine name. Demythologizing the divine name, and that is the Old Testament name that we no longer use, because this was a name that God used in covenant with the people in the Old Testament. Both gods were called this, JHVH, and we translate it as Jehovah, some as Yahweh. In my studies, I've discovered that Yahweh has no connection with the Hebrew at all, and is a name that came out of paganism. But now people are saying in our own fellowships that the name JHVH, translated Jehovah or Yehovah, some object to translating it into the English J with the hard sound and with the V, feeling that there was no J or no V ever in Hebrew. Well, that's not true. In the Middle Ages, I found references in the Ladino language of the Jewish community of Spain, the common use of the sound J and the common use of the sound V, in that a Y or an I or even C's or Z's, depending on how they were marked with the diacritical marks, would be spoken with the J sound. And the V sound would be exchanged with the B sound. Hava, haba, something of this sort. They were interchanged depending on how they were marked. So the sounds were in the language. I personally believe that when Tyndale translated out of the Hebrew with the tutorship of the teachers he had in Germany, he studied, as I believe, in the city of Worms, W-O-R-M-S, just like it sounds, the leading schools, Levitical schools, and I'll say Levitical as much as possible as opposed to Jewish, to make the distinction between the Levites in the Jewish community and the rabbis in the Jewish community. There was a big difference, even though both are called rabbis in the literature. The Levites treated the Old Testament text much differently than the rabbinic community did. And there's a very, very big difference there in how all of this plays out with how the name was translated. It's my personal belief that when Tyndale heard JHVH spoken in Ladino, that he heard Jehovah. That's where he got that. I believe Luther heard Jehovah. But when he wrote J in the German, there is no J sound, it's Yah. So the German schools, who have had the greatest influence over the last 200 years, for good or for evil, scholarship began to use the term Yehovah as opposed to Jehovah. And of course, it was an easy step to go into the paganism of Yahweh and to claim there's no J sound at all. Now, I haven't given you any evidence for this, so it's fair that you ask. If you ask, give me your name. I have a paper on this as well I can send to you with about, I don't know, a couple hundred references, 6 or 7 pages of reference material in journals and books, material I've gone through in the last 2 years. So I know it's not fair to give you the references now. It's not fair just to state my hypothesis, but there's nothing else I can do at this point in time. I'm in the middle of a series of tapes on this, in the middle of the research, and you're being brought into it, hopefully without too much confusion, in the middle of the stream. So if I can bring you into it and bring you online and we can go along with this, I'm not asking you to just believe everything I say. Check it for sure. I'm just asking you to check it. Many times people won't believe what I say, but they won't check it either. They won't go to the sources. If you don't go to the sources, if you don't check it out, well, then how can you condemn me for being right or wrong, or for being wrong? If you answer a matter before you've studied it, what does Scripture say? I don't need to say any more, I don't think, in that matter. But we should study these things as disciples of Jesus Christ. We're His students. We're to grow in grace and knowledge. When we're baptized, we don't have all knowledge. We don't have everything poured into our heads. And certainly a lot of the knowledge we've had has been lost over the years because of the dumbing down of the doctrine to the point where the brethren had no resources to use. So we're trying to get past that now and get into some material that is a bit technical. And as I said, might be offensive to people because I'm going to use some names. I'm not using them in naming them to hurt them or injure them, but to show you the source. And my name is on everything I do. I don't mind people using my name. Just don't call me late for supper. You can call me anything you want, but just don't call me late for supper, okay? So in the first section here, on demonizing of the name JHVH, I feel like people are trying to do this, probably inadvertently, but I personally believe it's a dangerous thing to do. The Gnostics did this at the time of Christ. They took the works of God the Father and Jesus Christ and attributed them to the devil. That's blasphemy. That's blaspheming the Holy Spirit of the Father and of Christ. We want to be very careful what we do. If these people are right, then I want to change to their side. If they're wrong, I would call upon them to change. But this seems to be growing, and I'm very positive that this is wrong, and want to present some of the evidence to you today in the time that I have. What I hope to do here is start with some of the problems that I've developed, give you a brief series of about 10 mythologies, reiterate them, and then go back through the first four or so with some hard evidence to show that these truly are mythologies. Once we destroy these mythologies, then the other problems begin to fall by the wayside. If you see what I mean, the demonizing of the name is based on, it's like an onion skin, based on an assumption, that's based on an assumption, that's based on another assumption. After a while, these assumptions are never spoken and never known by the people who are on the first layer. So the people on the first layer of the onion don't know what the core is. If we get to the core and find it's rotten, then everything else from there can be taken down automatically because the initial assumptions are wrong. This is what I'm attempting to do this morning. In other words, give you 5 hours worth of material in an hour and a half. So hang on to your seats. Here we go. Let me read a quote from a letter a lady wrote. This is the lady who confronted me a couple of years ago at the Feast of Tabernacles. The very first second I walked in the door, as I was walking in the door to the Feast of Tabernacles in Alabama, in southern Alabama, I was confronted with this. She later wrote this up. I've not seen anything written any more than this since this time. I did not receive this letter, even though I'm the cause of the problem. I'm the one who published the material using the name Jehovah. I did not receive this letter. It was sent to me by somebody else. She sent it to the other brethren, did not send me a copy. So I have a copy. I have the entire letter here in case you're worried about me quoting her out of context. I quote these two paragraphs because this is the only section of the letter that she addresses the question of God's name. And she writes, "The Stars, the Wilsons, and I continue to study the names issue and have discovered many interesting aspects concerning the name Jehovah," quote unquote. One startling piece of information you can find by looking up the meaning of Hova in Strong's, and the word is 1943, another form of for 1942, meaning ruin, mischief. 1942, Hava, from 1933, in the sense of eagerly coveting and rushing upon, by implication of falling. Now this is from Strong's Concordance, of course. Desire, also ruin, calamity, iniquity, mischief, mischievous thing, naughtiness, naughty, noisome, perverse thing, substance, very wickedness. We know whose characteristics fit the above description, exclamation point. Now that's not fair. That's begging the question. This is what people will do quite often. I don't know. She wants me to assume that this is Satan. It's a description of Satan, that Jehovah is the name of Satan the devil, and if we use the name Jehovah, therefore we're worshiping Satan the devil. There's no evidence of that here. She wants us to assume that. That's not right. It's not good logic. A good editor would catch this right away, go back to the person, and say, prove it. And it wouldn't get out. But we don't edit these things anymore. We don't edit ourselves. We don't take the time to stop and think things through far enough, publish things. Material floats around on the internet and gets shoved all around the world. Everybody works themselves up into a frenzy over nothing. Shakespeare's play, A Big Ado About Nothing, or something like that. You know, it's a big ado about nothing. This is not true. God's name, J-H-V-H, has no root verb. There is no root in the Hebrew. It's a primary word, it's a noun, that has no root. What she is saying here is that Hova is the root, and that Jah has been attached to it. So therefore the name Jehovah, built upon this root, comes from a name that means mischief, etc., etc., etc. No scholar, nobody writes about this. No one has said this. You won't find this in any legitimate literature. All I'm asking our brethren to do is to be careful in what they do. Now, if I'm asking you to be careful, I have to ask myself to be careful or doubly careful as well. I'm speaking, so, as God says, in much, and I'm bad at paraphrasing, let alone quoting something, let alone paraphrasing it, but you'll know what I'm referring to. In many words, there lacks not sin. When we speak, we say things that are sinful sometimes, inadvertently spewing things out, either out of our passion or anger or just our innocent reference to a word or phrase that offends someone. Okay? In writing, we don't need to do that. We have the opportunity to be careful. We can put our words down, go back and look at them. So what I would suggest, I wasn't going to say this, but my friend Tom suggested that maybe I bring something up like this because we were talking about it and it just seems to fit now. And if I keep this up, I'll never get through past the first or second page. But to use my wife as an example, the work that we're doing, she will not let anything get by me without past her, without great scrutiny. She not only is able to criticize me, but she's very willing to do so and takes every opportunity to let me know that my logic breaks down. She is my Spock. It doesn't compute. Where did you get this? And we'll go round and round about something. I don't mean fisticuffs or verbally shouting at each other or something, but mentally wrestling with it. And usually I'll get to the point where this mental wrestling happens when she'll take a whole page, cross it off, take it out of the work, and she cuts it down to one or two paragraphs. I had five or six pages to begin with, and she's cut me down to one or two paragraphs. I worked for a day or weeks on that. You can't do that to me. Well, what did you mean to say here? And we'll start talking. And then it'll come out. Well, what I really meant to say was this. Well, then why didn't you say that? Okay, even after that, we go through a series of re-editing and re-editing and re-editing. Is this what we really mean to say? The gift of a good editor is that he or she can put himself into the shoes of the listener, the reader. Put yourself in the other person's mind. Try to do that as you write, as you type on the internet. Or maybe type it out before you get on the internet. Take a look at it. Sit on it. The next morning you may feel differently about it. And then it won't have to go out and cause all the trouble it causes. I'm not against communication. I'm not against brothers and sisters passing information back and forth on the internet. I'm all in favor of that. I'm just cautioning us to be careful, to be wise, to be considerate of the other person on the other end, to think things through and not jump to conclusions and offend others unnecessarily. If you're going to offend them, really mean what you say and have something to back it up. You're always going to offend someone. We can't back off from that. But if she had just thought it through a little more, or had, if they could have, or just had other friends look at it, or had looked at some of the journals, looked at some of the material, taken a little more time. This was written well after, a year after I was confronted at the feast. It would have helped. It wouldn't be out. But now this material is starting to float around, and people are beginning to believe that the name Jehovah is the name of Satan the devil. It is not. It is absolutely is not. One writer just recently wrote that Jehovah is the name for Lucifer. This is a fellow out of Illinois who publishes a newsletter. This is the April 96 issue. And he quotes a Masonic book and writes this: "That name of God, which we at a venture pronounce Jehovah, although whether this is or is not, the true pronunciation can now never be authoritatively settled." That's not true. And I'll very briefly show that to you. This is one of the myths that's been passed on, one of the fables Paul talks about that came out of the rabbinic Judaism. This is a fable. We can know. We must know. At least he says this: "It can never be authoritatively settled, was ever held by the Jews in the most profound veneration." That is not true. That is another myth. They had rebelled so much against God, he kicked them out of the land. They hated God so much, they said, "Well, we're not even going to use your name." That's in the last part of the paper that we just finished, and I gave Lionel copies of the Two Jehovahs of the Pentateuch. The last 20 pages cover the Shema and the development of the Shema and how it has been mistranslated, mishandled, misused, misunderstood, and that the monotheism of Judaism goes back to the worship of Mithras, back to Osiris, back to Nimrod, back. There is a trail all the way back to the beginning in the Garden of Eden, to the dragon and the snake who said, "Eve, by the way, you know, if you do this, you'll gain a lot of knowledge. He's the one who has a secret name." That's where it all goes back to. But Jehovah
YHVH or JHVH, as used in Scripture, as revealed to Adam, as used by God, recorded by God in Genesis 2:4, the first place it's used. Jehovah Elohim, is, I believe that's the first place. If I'm wrong, correct me. But it's used very early on in the entire record. God introduces himself to mankind in his record, the only record we have, beginning in the book of Genesis with this name. This is what he calls himself. This is not a name of Lucifer, not a name of the devil, not a name of anything, Cain or anything evil. This is God's, one of God's name that he used in the Old Testament. He didn't bring it over into the New, but he used it back in that literature. They derived its origin from the immediate inspiration of the Almighty, it's true, who communicated it to Moses at his especial appellation, as his special appellation, to be used only by his chosen people. Not true. Another myth. I won't have time to get to all the myths. God never intended that he just be the God of the Jews or the Israelites wandering around the desert. And that's in our paper as well. When you go, we know it, brethren. When you go back to the Psalms and the prophets, it talks about God in the world, universal sense. All mankind, all humans would know him, not just a select few. God is not the God of a few Israelites walking around on cacti in the Egyptian peninsula. And this communication was made at the burning bush, true. When he said to him, "Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, Jehovah, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me unto you." That's true. "This Jehovah is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations." And at a subsequent period, he still more emphatically declared this to be his peculiar name. Quote, "I am Jehovah, and I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of El Shaddai. But by my name Jehovah was I not known unto them." Now, this is a weak translation here. He was not known in the same relationship, but they knew him by the name Jehovah. And you can show this from a critical analysis of the text itself. That's quoted by James Torkey from in his newsletter. The article was entitled "The Ancient Mysteries and the Ineffable Name." And this is taken from McKay's Symbolism of Freemasonry, pages 176 and 177. He goes on to quote McKay. McKay goes on to say that the Kabbalists changed a letter in the scripture which changed this in my name, this is my name forever, and to this is my name, and to this is my name to be concealed. That's not true. The Hebrew text, the Masoretic text, was not changed there. I have them in my home. I trace the history of the Masoretic text. This is a lie. It's a deception. It's a refocus. It wasn't changed. They took the name JHVH and added the character of the Hebrew S to it and came up with Yeshua. But that's totally philologically impossible, as Dr. Dorothy points out in a recent article, within the last 2 years that he wrote to Ken Westby's association or associated ministry, whatever, associated churches. That's not true. It's not in Scripture. They didn't modify that. There are other places where they inserted Elohim for Jehovah and inserted Jehovah for Elohim, but they marked it. God didn't let them get away with the willy-nilly change of the Scripture. They had to keep a record of what they changed and pass on and confess to the rest of us that mistake and that sin. Why God allowed it to remain there, I'm not sure. But we know that Jehovah should be there as opposed to Elohim or vice versa or some other name. In their zeal to conceal the name, the Jews, according to McKay, even changed the spelling so that only those who had heard the name would know what it was. Now it's been marked as Jehovah from the beginning. That's the essence of the Hebrew language that has not changed in pronunciation or in the consonantal spelling from the time it was first written down. And scholars know this. They admit it. I have their quotes here that I'll get to in about 5 or 6 hours. No, I won't do that to you. I wouldn't last anyway. Let's take this a step further. McKay says that Jehovah is God's name. Now, I want you to follow the logic here because this is a perfect example of a logic flaw. It does not follow. Whatever it was, it's gone. Well, it was on the tip of my tongue. It'll come to me. It's a Latin term for it. But it means it does not follow. Let's take this a step further. McKay says that Jehovah is God's name. Right? Okay, there's a premise. That's right. So he's beginning to deduce. This is the fellow writing the book now, or this article, The Ancient Mysteries and the Ineffable Name, Turkey, out of Illinois. Which God does he and his fellows worship? That is a loaded question. He already is setting us up to come to the answer as the false God. That's the logic, another flaw in logic. This is what people do. They'll start with the right premise, then they'll ask a question that sets you up. That's not the right question that should be asked, and flag should go up right there going, uh-oh, something's coming, I'm going to get it now. We know the answer to be Lucifer. Now, he got from Jehovah as being God's name, the true God's name, in two steps to Lucifer. That's a deduction he made. But the last statement is not relevant to the first, that Jehovah truly is God's name. It is not relevant and is not an accurate deduction because the proof that Jehovah is Lucifer is not embedded in the first premise or the second premise. It's totally illogical, totally irrelevant, totally irresponsible, and Torquay should retract it. It's bad English, bad grammar, bad everything, bad theology for sure. And is setting people up to demonize God's name, the name that he went by in the Old Testament, and push everybody into Yahweh, push everybody into Yahweh's compounds, push everybody into a camp with FBI and ATF automatic rifles being shoved down your throats, if you survive the initial assault of C3 or whatever it was, yet they supposedly didn't use. Okay, another, in the same newsletter, another fellow says that JHVH is a name for Nimrod. So we've gotten from Lucifer, Satan, to Lucifer, to Nimrod. We're making the trek. We're on our way down. In the March-April 96 edition, Herschel Shanks shows that the horse was associated with the worship of Yahweh. I don't doubt that. Probably was. Yahweh was an Amoritic god. It's an Amoritic name. Personal god of the Amorites, who used it as on their amulets and their secret rings as a personal god to call upon him, like Buck Rogers when they were in trouble, or Dick Tracy. Yahweh, are you there? Save me. You know, it was the god in their back pocket. So he was a personal family god of the Amorites, but not the god of the Old Testament. Now again, follow this logic with me. Daniel brings out the fact, this is Daniel in the Bible, that Nimrod was associated with the horse. Okay, I'm sure he was. So are my neighbors. My neighbors have horses. So what? What is the relevancy of this? There are teenage girls and boys in my neighborhood that ride horses up and down the road. Now what should I conclude from that? That they're Lucifer's agents because they're connected with horses? Nimrod was also famous among pagans for having subdued the horse. So did my neighbor. He was legendary. He's a great big Polish fellow. He's dead now, by the name of Szymanowski, with two or three Z's in it, so don't try to spell it. Don't ask me to. He was a big man. In his youth, he raised horses. He had teamed a pair of horses that ran away with one of his young daughters. He ran out there, grabbed the reins, knocked the horses down, subdued the horses. He was a big, strong, fearless man, a wonderful neighbor, a wonderful guy to do anything for you. He wouldn't knock you down. But I mean, he saw unless you got in front of his bulldozer or something, he didn't see you, or his back home. To this feat, we can perhaps attribute his great military success, okay? Pagan religions commemorated Nimrod's mastery of the horse in the mythological figure of the centaur. Okay, it might be true. According to Scarlet and the Beast, another book, Nimrod's name was the ineffable name. I believe that. Couldn't pronounce it. One of the sacred names. This is where sacred names comes from. Not from the Bible, in pagan worship. Nimrod's idolatrous priesthood literally went underground with their religion. Right, because Nimrod was killed, Semiramis had to flee. For 30-some years, she was underground from about 2167 B.C. to 2137. That's 30 years. She reappears with a little baby who's blonde and blue-eyed, the supposed reincarnation of Nimrod. Yes, they did go underground, and he did have a sacred name. So did Nimrod, the dead Nimrod. To avoid exposure, the ancient Babylonian priesthood met in caverns beneath the earth and there developed an elaborate system of secret rituals that would take the initiate priest by degrees through a hodgepodge of deities, all of whom represented Nimrod in his various manifestations. In search for his original lost name, yes. I don't have any doubt with that, any problem with that. Here's what I have a problem with. In the final initiation, the ancient priesthood would whisper Nimrod's Babylonian name Bel in the ear of the initiated priest, who was then told to never divulge the secret, lost name of God, capital G-O-D. See the link that was just made after all this? That's probably true. That's probably true. That's probably true. Torque. Refocus. Twist off to the side. The argument suddenly has changed. Now we've linked all this secret name stuff with Jehovah, with the God of the Old Testament. You see what they've done in their logic? Brethren, do everything you can. Pray as hard as you can to ask God to give you the spirit of discernment to pick up on where these people go astray. Or they'll lead us astray if we're not careful. Inadvertently, just refocusing us and just leading us down the primrose path. What does this tell us about YHWH? Uh-oh. All of a sudden we got to Nimrod, to God. Now what does it tell us about him? I think I'm being set up again. Here comes the bowling ball. I'm over. It must be associated with Nimrod. So now we've got Jehovah is the secret name of Nimrod. Not the name of the God of the Old Testament. So if you or I use the name Jehovah, we're worshiping Satan. We're worshiping Satan. Not true. It's false. Is Jehovah a modern reconstruction of JHVH? This is another question in the same article, as the one above. Satan's best kept secret, the ineffable name, from the same newsletter. This is by Aaron Newport. Have you ever heard of the Tetragrammaton? We all have, haven't we? It's just the Greek word for four characters, four letters, JHVH. It happened to be the secret, one of the secrets was copied by the Alexandrian Gnostics out of Scripture, a legitimate name of God in the Old Testament, and used by them as a secret name. That doesn't make God's name originally wrong. They took the name and misused it, just as people today use the name Christ when worshiping the false god. They were doing the same thing back there. Now they're bringing it, false worship, Gnostic worship, back in, not just with the name of Christ, but using the God of the name of the God of the Old Testament as well. Have you ever heard of the Tetragrammaton or ineffable name? Webster's Unabridged Dictionary says this of Tetragrammaton, quote, "The four consonants of the ancient Hebrew name for God, JHVH, IHVH, JHVH, YHWH, considered too sacred to pronounce," not true. The scriptures they quote, if you look them up, have nothing to do with the pronunciation, but with turning God's name into an idol, and idol worship in God's name. That was the prohibition in Exodus and in Numbers and scriptures they quote. It has nothing to do with whether you can pronounce it or not. That's a lie that the Gnostic Jews and Levites brought in starting in the 300s B.C. to justify their sin. The word Adonai, which is a legitimate word for God in the Old Testament, it's a name that's also used by the pagans, from Greece all the way through Babylon, all the way through the Mediterranean region, except in the Roman Empire, as I recall. The word Adonai, Lord, is substituted for his name in utterance, and the vowels of Adonai or Elohim are inserted in Hebrew texts so that the modern reconstructions are Yahweh or Jehovah. This is from the Unabridged Dictionary. That's not true. Now let me show you where they go off. Adonai is right. It does mean Lord. It was substituted in reading by the pagan priests, by the Hasidic Jews who didn't want to use God's name, Jehovah. And the rabbis admit it was pronounced Jehovah by the priests. Rabbi Kohler admits that, and we have that as one of the quotes in the material I gave Lionel. Now, this is where they torque it and twist it off. And the vowels of Adonai, or Elohim, meaning God, are inserted in Hebrew texts. No, they weren't. Another myth. They didn't take JHVH, take the vowels of a couple other names, and throw them around like a juggler and put them under the J, the Yoda. And that's one of the ways it's pronounced. Remember the little character, the little ugly character in Star Wars? What was his name? Yoda. Comes from Kabbalistic worship. May the Force not be with you. That little Yoda. Stay away from that guy. Especially if you find him in a... Stay away from swamps, period, you know. You can. But stay away from Yoda. Show you, and I'll leave material, I'll leave this material with Lionel, because he's the contact person here, and you can copy as much as you want. And take a look at it. Go take a look at the sources, whatever you want to do with it, because it'll be too much to read here anyway, I'm sure, all of it. But I can show you that they did not take the vowel pointings when the Levites, the Masoretes, marked the consonants. They did not at that time take the vowel pointings of other words and put them under YHVH to give us the bastard, this is the term they use, illegitimate or bastard term, Jehovah. That's not true. That's another myth. There's layer upon layer upon layer upon layer upon layer of myth. When we end up 2,000, 3,000 years later, we have this web and layered mythology that it's taken me 2 years to begin to wade through. So I can understand why people misunderstand it. I can understand why scholars don't get the point. You have to understand, brethren, that to get your PhD and to enter into the scholarship of this world, you have to be the most conformist of all people. You have to toe the line, or you will not get the job. You have to please their theories about language or whatever you're going into, physics or whatever it is, or you won't get the job. Science is not a group of free-thinking people. Not made up of a group of free-thinking people. Mathematicians are not free thinkers. Scientists of all ilk are not free thinkers. They stopped about 100 years ago describing the physical universe, and they went to, at the time of Darwin, to prescribing the universe. These people have done the same thing that brought in the wrong terminology, the terminology Yahweh. They're pushing aside the name Jehovah, the true understanding of the Old Testament, covenant form of God's name. This is Darwinism at its worst that we have inherited. This is a theological platypus. Now, God made the platypus, and there's a reason for that. There's a reason for this. God didn't make this. This is theological garbage. And we've got to stop just passing it on, passing it on, passing it on, passing it on. It's got to stop somewhere. So, should I say the garbage stops here? That'd be the way Homer Simpson might say it. The garbage stops here. The modern reconstruction of is not Jehovah. It's not a reconstruction. It's been God's name from the beginning. It's been his pronunciation from the beginning. Now, this is a little more abstract, so let me give you a little background. This is entitled, this is The Myth of the Perpetual Reading. The Myth of the Perpetual Reading. I've taken this from the introduction to the NIV Interlinear Hebrew English Old Testament, all recently published. I think it was in the late 80s or early 90s. And the scholar who wrote this introduction is Kohlenberger III. And I assume it's in all four volumes, but this was taken from the first volume, Genesis and Deuteronomy, pages 18 and 19. I'll read the whole thing to you. Because this is, we're getting now down into one of the inner layers of the mythology, one of the myths that's down inside the onion ring. We're not to the core yet. But it's upon this that all the rest of the mythology is built. They use this to justify everything else they say. This is why Webster's wrote the way they did, because they went to the scholars who wrote about this, who assumed this was true, and it gets passed on for the next 200 years and nobody checks it. It's like there was a cute story in the Reader's Digest a few years ago where a GI was painting a bench at Pearl Harbor. The day, I think this, as I remember, the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed, strafed. He painted the bench, left a sign on it, "Do not sit." The sign remained for the next 20 or 30 years or whatever. After all the confusion, after a while, people forgot what the sign was for and just took it as a command, "Don't sit here." So there was a bench there outside one of the Barak said, don't sit here. So nobody sat there for the next 20, 30, 40 years. Nobody questioned it. What scholars will do is put signs on benches that say intellectually, don't sit here. And so don't let your mind rest here. Don't wrestle with this. This is none of your business. We know what's going on. We'll speak for you. Now that smacks me of the ancient arrogance of the Catholic Church that locked the Bible up and said, oh, you can't understand Scripture. It takes a priest to interpret it. Who are the new priests of our culture? If you had been reared a Catholic, you would have been reared in that culture, so you'd have two cultures that believe this. We have Catholic friends who have a beautiful Bible in their front room, but they won't read it because they say they can't understand it. And these are people who studied for the priesthood, and one studied to be a nun. They broke away from that and got married, obviously. They would still be in the priesthood or be a nun. Wonderful people. Nevertheless, don't sit on this. Don't do anything with this. No, we can't read that and understand it. It takes a priest to understand that. Well, our priests are scholars. One of them is named Kohlenberger III, who is a high priest of theology who writes, oh, you can't understand this. Don't dabble. This is the word he uses. Don't dabble with this. Well, all of you are dabbling today. We're disobeying the high priesthood of scholarship. We're dabbling. If you don't dabble, you will be mudded up in that fence that's all daubed up with all kinds of false mythology and false doctrine, stuck in there theologically, being told something is right or wrong, and having no way of figuring it out or no way of discerning it because you're stuck in that daubed up wall of false scholarship. The ancient textual variance noted within the Masoretic text, which occurred when the reading of the text, that is the Ketib, and I'll just from now on refer to the Ketib and the Kira, two Hebrew terms meaning, Ketib meaning to read, or to write as written, and Kira meaning to read. The Kira was in the margin. When you read something in the text and it was marked to go to the margin, you were supposed to read. This is what the mythology is. Read the marginal reading. And from this they developed the notion that they took the vowels from Adonai and stuck them under Jehovah. And then they built the next mythology, and the next thing you know, Jehovah is Satan, and Jehovah is Nimrod, Jehovah is anything but the true name of the true God of the Old Testament. This is a very important layer of myth, mythology. So the K and the Q. The K is in the text, the Q is in the margin. Just remember the K and the Q and you've got it. So the Ketib, that which is written, was corrected for the proper pronunciation or spelling by a reading in the margin, Kereth, the Q. Read, he asked, question mark. That's a myth. That's not true. Scholarship since the 60s has absolutely shown that that is not right. It's in the journals, if you dig it out. It's there. But Kohlenberger doesn't seem to either read them or care about the recent study and absolute proof that this is a falsehood. Either way, I don't know the man, I can't judge his heart. Either way, he's not doing it and he's passing on mythology. Falsehoods to us in the grossest way. In the grossest way. Anyway, they have nothing to do with the pronunciation, nothing to do with correcting the text. It's just a variant that they weren't sure. It was a minor variant in one of the major Masoretic texts when they copied and formed the text that was the codex to use from then on. And so being true to their scholarship, they left a reference in the margin that this may be a legitimate reading, but they're not sure. It had nothing to do with correcting the text or changing the vowel system for the pronunciation at all. Nothing. Nothing whatsoever. The K form is given in a footnote with it. This is talking about the NIV interlinear. Now, the Masoretic text in the NIV interlinear is good. Nothing wrong with the Hebrew. It's the way they treat it. It's what they do with it. And this is part of what they're doing with it. They're setting us up, setting the reader up. The Q form is given in a footnote with its verse numbers preceded by the small circle. When there are more than one type of footnote on a page, the KQ is always at the bottom of the page in the NIV interlinear. The KQ is always at the bottom of the page. For example, number is 12:3. The exception to this occurs when the Q form is a different word or word division than the K. Now, this goes back and forth. Sorry about that. That's the way the guy has written, but
Bear with me. At least you know this is in the NIV interlinear. You can go to a theological library around Detroit, and they'll have it. And you can pull it off the shelf, and you can buy it from CBD, the whole set, for 30, 40 bucks or something like that. If you're into this kind of scholarship, it would be good to have, because it shows how they misuse a totally legitimate Masoretic text and begin to pervert it, because they take a God's text that is he's preserved to the Levites, that's a legitimate text. They bring in Gnostic texts and begin to evaluate the legitimate text through the eyes of the pagan priesthood. And then you come up with an English called the NIV that's twisted and perverted and warped and all out of shape. Some of you may have gotten one of Fred's recent tapes on the New Age Bible and how they're warping and twisting it. This is, the NIV in particular, is one of the first ones they started to do this. If you were to get this set, it would give you an idea of how they go about doing it. It would take some time to go through it, so it's the kind of thing you have to curl up with when you go to bed. You know, fall asleep with it, get up in the morning and read it, and be diligent. Your wife will be a widow for a while, but you know, the scholarship is worth it. Four forms in the Hebrew Bible are always pronounced differently. They're called perpetual readings. Differently from the way they are pointed. Not true. A myth. Yet are not noted in the KQ. So you're not going to find this in the margin, is KQ reference. Where did this come from then? I can find no Jewish source, no rabbi that will attest to this, going back all the way through the Talmud and the Mishnah and any other legend I could find. I could find nothing in any journal that made the link from this bold statement to trace this back. I don't know where it came from. Somebody picked it up and passed it on and passed it on and passed it on. They just put a sign there, don't sit. No one knows why, everybody believes this and passes it on. Of these so-called perpetual readings, three occur in this volume. And of course, the first one, the most one, is Jehovah, the most important one. So let me read, I'm skipping the others, I'll read this to you. And he uses the name Yahweh, by the way, which is totally illegitimate. There's no justification for that at all. But he has the Hebrew characters, YHVH or JHVH. And then he says, Yahweh, the proper name of God, is either pointed with the vowels of Adonai, he has the Hebrew, for Jehovah, or Elohim, God, for Jehovah, and is to be pronounced as the word whose vowels it borrows. That's a myth. That's not right. It's not true. Yes, you'll read it in the journals. Yes, you'll read it. The scholars will pass this on. I'm here to tell you they're wrong. They're wrong. Now, that gets pretty scary for me to sit here and say they're wrong, but brethren, my nose led me to this branch, and it led me out to the end of it. So either I'm very, very right, or I'm very, very wrong. There's nothing in between, and it's a long way to the ground. It took me 2 years to get to this point, so I tried to stack up enough stuff so that when I got to the top of the barrel and looked out, that the fall wouldn't be that far if I did do something wrong. I've gone back through and looked at this, tried to re-verify it, to re-verify it, and to re-verify it for 2 years. Typed and typed and typed. This is some of the material, quotes that I've typed out. They're on disk. There is some repetition in this. It's not all original, because this is how I do the research and begin to pull it together toward our writing and pull the quotes out. This is some of it. Just some of it. So I've tried. At least I've tried. It's not just something where I've gone to the Webster's Dictionary and said, there it is. Or read the NIV and said, that's it. Because he says something else in here that's a gross piece of mythology that I've spent not the last 2 years looking specifically for this fellow, but I knew of the name, and if I'd run across him, it would have set up a flag and I would have pursued that, because that's the way you have to do research. Research is like a hound dog on a trail that's either fresh and gets better or is fresh and gets old. And sometimes you bark up the wrong tree. There's nothing up there. So you have to just admit you followed the wrong trail and back off and find out where you went wrong and follow another trail. That's the way research is.
I've been following all these trails over the last few years, and this is what I come up with. This man is wrong, whether he realizes it or not. Maybe he can read and translate all the Hebrew in the world going back to the original. The original, by the way, was written from left to right. The oldest archaeological records of the Hebrew are from left to right. They're not right to left, which is interesting. The characters in the ancient Hebrew look very much like English characters. O's, Y's, W's, V's, things of this sort, as far as the characters themselves. So, is it possible that with Tyndale translating from the Hebrew from right to left into the English from left to right, with characters that are very similar to the ancient Hebrew, that God has restored something for his people? I think there's a great possibility of that, and that's one of the things I want to pursue and write up. It's an interesting thought